more time in the water, and have more hand-to-mouth behavior that can increase their exposure. So, given the risks, what regulations and guidance do we have for HCBs and cyanotoxins? Currently, we do not have federal standards for cyanobacteria or cyanotoxins. However, we do have guidance from the US EPA for the toxins microcystin and cylindrospermopsin in both recreational and drinking water. In March 2021, the World Health Organization released recreational guidance for four toxins: microcystin LR, anatoxin A, cylindrospermopsin, and saxitoxin. Additionally, many states have developed their own regulatory or guidance values for HCBs and cyanotoxins. However, these tend to be focused on planktonic HCBs. Guidelines for benthic cyanobacteria are lacking, and ITRC has some guidance for benthic cyanobacteria, which is now available on the ITRC website. So please stay tuned for the next modules in this training that will cover guidance and selection tools to help you develop a management plan for HCBs. Next, we're going to cover monitoring for cyanobacteria and cyanotoxins. Other modules address communication and response plans, in-lake management and control methods, and nutrient reduction as a strategy to reduce HCB occurrence. So now we'll hear from Ben Holcomb from the Utah Department of Environmental Quality, who will be covering monitoring for cyanobacteria.
Thanks for the introduction, Gina. In this section of our HCB training, we'll talk about how to monitor. I'll talk about analytical methods used to evaluate cyanobacteria and cyanotoxins, and about field collection methods, basically how you fill that water bottle which will be eventually delivered to the lab. I'll demonstrate the use of interactive selection tool the team has developed to help you explore which analytical methods may be useful for your water body and your goals. Finally, we'll talk about the elements of a cyanobacteria monitoring program where we finish this section of today's training. You should have a basic understanding of how to design and conduct a monitoring program to meet your needs. Let's start with how we monitor for cyanobacteria. Monitoring provides the data you need to describe conditions. For HCBs, that means counts and measures of cyanobacteria and cyanotoxins. They'll help you describe what kind of toxins or cyanobacteria is present, how much there is, when and where it's found. You may also choose to include water quality parameters that describe conditions that support HCB growth or how HCBs are affected by management strategies you've started in the lake or in the watershed. I'll talk more about this a little later in the training. The most important objective when monitoring for HCBs is to support your HCB response plan. A response plan tells you what to do when a bloom is reported and outlines what level of cyanobacteria or cyanotoxin will require you to act, such as closing a beach or posting signs along a recreational path. You'll learn about response plans in the next segment of our training today and can read more about it in Section 5 of our guidance document. As I mentioned before, HCB monitoring can support your HCB management activities. Actions to control cyanobacteria can be focused in the lake itself, such as the application of phosphorus-binding chemicals, as you see in the photo here, or be undertaken in the watershed to reduce the source of nutrients that encourage the growth of cyanobacteria. If you decide to include monitoring for management success in your HCB program, you'll want to begin monitoring before the management action starts so that you can characterize the cyanobacteria community before conditions change. After your management begins, you'll continue to monitor to use the same methods so you can track how the community responds to your management. More on this monitoring approach will be discussed in the management and control section later in today's training. A monitoring plan is all about your needs. It will identify the methods you will use in the field, specifically making sure you get the data you need for those action or alert levels called out in your response plan. Because you know how often you'll sample, the cost of the analyses, and the number of people you need to do the work, you can set a budget for the program. This is important to keep you from spending all your funding in June when you know blooms will still occur in August and September. A plan also helps create and maintain consistency across time. When a bloom occurs, things get hectic fast. Lots of people are calling for information, and lots of people have concerns about their health. Having a plan means you don't need to think long about what's appropriate to collect or where to go. You've already decided that. Having a plan also means you collect the same data in the same way each season and can better compare current data to past experience or track trends over time. The terms monitoring and sampling are often used interchangeably. However, they do have different meanings. In our guidance, sampling refers to the collection of a single point of data in response to a bloom, as you see the person in the photo filling a bottle from a visible scum. Monitoring is the collection of routine data to detect impending blooms or track changes over time. Monitoring represents a series of samples, including some that may be collected in response to a bloom situation, visiting the same locations at set intervals, regardless of whether a bloom is present. So let's turn now to the actual methods to use to measure cyanobacteria. Our guidance document discusses six methods commonly used to decide whether cyanobacteria are present and how much might be there. You can see the methods here on the slide. They range from the simple methods like that require minimal training and not many tools to those that are more complex, requiring specific training and often very complex equipment. Each method is evaluated using the same set of criteria. You can see the criteria on the screen here. We discuss, for example, the kind of result method provides, say, cells per mil or micrograms per liter for chlorophyll A. In the document, there's a summary of these criteria for each method, so you can easily compare one method to another. It's very important that you understand the criteria we use. We've provided a definition of each in our guidance, and you should take a look at that to be sure your interpretation of what the criteria means matches ours. Consider turnaround time, for example. We define turnaround time as the time needed to prepare the sample, run the analysis, and get the raw data. If you're sending a team into the field to collect a sample, that time is not included in our definition. To fully estimate how much time it'll take before you have the data to share, you need to add field time to the turnaround time. If your sample location is located far from your laboratory, there are very few methods that will get data to you in less than a day. There's one very important thing to remember about cyanobacteria methods. They do not provide any information about cyanobacteria toxins. It's not possible to use any of these methods to tell what kind of cyanotoxins may be present. You must use a method designed specifically to test for toxins. So let's turn now to look at those methods to test for cyanotoxins. Our guidance covers six methods commonly used for evaluating toxins. Like the cyanobacteria methods, they range from those that are simple and require minimal tools to those that require specialized training and equipment. Similar to cyanobacteria, we use a single set of criteria to evaluate each method and summarize them in a table associated with each method so you can easily compare them. There are some key things to remember about cyanotoxin analytical methods. No single method can provide information about all possible toxins. You cannot fill a bottle, run it on one machine one time, and learn about all the cyanotoxins. If you want to know about antitoxin A, microcystin, or cyanobromopsin, you'll need to run three separate analyses and account for this in your monitoring plan. And guidance values may not be available for all cyanotoxins. Guidance values help you understand the meaning of your toxin result. 4.5 micrograms per liter of microcystin is just a number without guidance telling you how to interpret and use it. There are federal guidance values for several cyanotoxins, and some states have also developed their own. As you build your monitoring plan, it's important to know what guidance values are applicable to your water body. Another thing to remember is that there might be interference from compounds, environmental or otherwise, when analyzing your samples. It's important to understand your method and possible interferences so you can use the proper bottles, proper preservation, or otherwise minimize their effect on your analyses. Your samples may require specific preparation or extraction. This is especially important for plant and animal tissues. They require very different preparation from water samples. These preparation methods are continually changing and improving, so it's important to review available methods and use the best sample preparation for your goals. Finally, it's also important to remember that cyanotoxin results tell you only about conditions at the time you filled your bottle. They can't tell you about what happened 2 days ago or predict what will happen 2 days or even 2 hours into the future. They're a snapshot of one point in time and need to be used with that in mind. Let's talk now about sample collection methods, how you'll fill the bottle that will be analyzed at the lab. We created a flowchart to help you decide which methods you'll use. You see a part of it here. The full flowchart is in the guidance document though. You select the water body type, for example, still water versus flowing water, possible locations to sample, and then you can see which methods may be appropriate. The location of the HCB is important in deciding which field sampling approach to use. We have developed a graphic to remind you of possible locations for HCBs. You'll find it in our guidance document. If you're looking for are looking at a floating HCB, you'll use methods for plankton. If you're looking at the bottom, say for example, your HCB is a benthic bloom attached to plants or washed up on the shoreline, you'll use the benthic approaches. If you're interested in cyanotoxins that may be in the water, that is extracellular toxins, you'll use another set of methods. The HCB1 guidance document is focused primarily on planktonic, that is floating HCBs, but we've added a new document, HCB2, with information about benthic HCBs. Training focused on HCB2 will occur separately, and the first training starts this Thursday. So now let's move on to how to build a monitoring plan for your water body. A monitoring plan is the story of what you're going to do. It tells everyone why you're sampling, when, where, and how you'll sample, as well as who will do the work. A monitoring plan for Largeville Reservoir, as shown here in the slide, the fictional lake shown here, would consider a monitoring plan to meet the needs of all stakeholders on the lake, federal, state, county facilities, the two drinking water facilities, as well as the boating, swimming, and fishing public. As you consider developing a monitoring plan for a location like Largeville Reservoir, you'll want to consider sustainability in the long term. Your budget needs to include sufficient resources to cover staff and analytical costs, any training needs, any quality control requirements. And as I mentioned before, for a large water body that is subject to frequent blooms, monitoring costs can be high if you try to do everything. It's important to find that sustainable balance between getting all the information you want and the basic information you need. Partnerships with stakeholders around the water body can help with sustainability. If you consider Largeville Reservoir, there are several stakeholders who could assist with your monitoring. Beach and boat launch managers can report on daily cyanobacteria conditions. Drinking water facilities may be able to cover the costs of some of the cyanotoxin analyses. There may be other options as well. And don't forget to consider whether there are additional environmental conditions you'd like to track along with cyanobacteria. Adding something as basic as water clarity measurements, as shown here on the slide, to your monitoring visits adds only a little time and the cost of a Secchi disc. It's a simple measure that you may allow you to evaluate both cyanobacteria presence and the effectiveness of your BMPs. All right, now I'd like to demonstrate the use of our monitoring tool to evaluate which analytical methods might be appropriate for your lake. We'll use Largeville Reservoir as an example of how you might build a monitoring program. There have been no previous bloom reports on this water body, so there's no monitoring program in place currently. However, a dog illness has been reported from the county boat ramp. The state investigated the area and confirmed the presence of both cyanobacteria and cyanotoxins. They recommend that a monitoring program be developed for the reservoir. Because this is the first bloom reported from Largeville Reservoir, they don't have a cyanobacteria response plan to follow. However, they have some basic information they would like their monitoring program to provide. They'd like to be able to quickly learn about cyanobacteria conditions so they can communicate rapidly with the public. They would also like to monitor in such a way to get a heads up when conditions may indicate a bloom is forming. Finally, they want to make sure that their monitoring provides information for the drinking water facilities, the recreational activities on the reservoir, and to keep pets safe. This slide shows how the monitoring tool appears on our webpage. It includes all the criteria that we use to evaluate each method. Three of these criteria allow you to whittle down the list of 12 methods to those that are of more interest. For example, if we want to find those that are the fastest, we would uncheck the box indicating a lab is required. And we also uncheck the box for a turnaround time of 1 to 3 days. This will get us to the quickest methods for cyanobacteria and cyanotoxins. When you make the selection, this list of cyanobacteria methods appears. Note that I couldn't include the cyanotoxin methods on the slide because of the space. The list of methods appears on the left side of the table. All methods are hyperlinked directly to the guidance document so you can easily read about them. The first six columns are color-coded. Green indicates the method is appropriate for the criteria. Red indicates that it's not. Let's look at the first three criteria under cyanobacteria. The first, P/A, refers to the ability of the method to tell you whether cyanobacteria are present or absent. All four methods have green circles, meaning they can be used to tell if cyanobacteria are present. The next criteria, ID, refers to the ability of the method to identify to the genus level, whether you have microcystis or dolichospermum, for example. All circles here are red, indicating these methods can't do that. The third criteria, DEN, refers to the ability of the method to evaluate the density of cyanobacteria, and you can see that those two methods can be used for this, while the other two cannot. All three of the cyanotoxin criteria have red circles, reinforcing what I said earlier, that cyanobacteria methods cannot tell you whether cyanotoxins are present. You can also use the monitoring tool to quickly compare all the methods to one another. For example, if you're looking for methods that are lower in cost, you'd read about those methods indicated by $1 or $2 signs. For those that can be done just about by anyone, you'd look at those identified as having a level of training at novice or intermediate. Again, all methods are hyperlinked directly to the text for that method in the document, so you can quickly and easily compare them to one another. So finally, let's wrap up the discussion on monitoring by reviewing the key things I'd like you to remember when you're building a monitoring plan. First, be sure to identify your goals and choose those analytical methods that get you the data you need. If your guidance says beaches will be closed when cell counts exceed 100,000 cells per mil, using a visual assessment will not get you the information you need to close a beach. Use our monitoring selection tool to evaluate methods and find those that can meet your needs. Build your monitoring plan to tell the full story, the who, what, when, where, and why. And make a plan to meet your needs. Your needs are outlined in your HCB response plan and may also be incorporated into an HCB management plan. Finally, consider how to make your plan sustainable in the long run so you can compare current and past conditions. Now I'll turn it over to Devin so we can get our first set of questions.
All right. Thank you, Ben. We will now begin our first question and answer portion of the training today. Just remember, at any time, you can type your questions into the Q&A pod, and we will either address them during the Q&A portion or through typing in the Q&A pod. All right, so let's get started. First question for our trainers, do you have field safety recommendations for monitoring staff to reduce exposure to cyanotoxins, including PPE recommendations, example of a respirator?
Well, sure. I can answer that question. It's important if you're sampling blooms, since you could possibly have toxins present, to just be really conscious of your skin exposure. So doing things like wearing gloves if you're taking grab samples from the water. If you need to wade, wearing waders to keep that cyanobacteria off your skin and from getting stuck under, say, wading sandals. It's also important to just have good basic hygiene. And if you're out in the field and you're going to have a field lunch, wash your hands or clean them as best as you can before you eat or drink. Regarding respirators, respirators really do require training and specific fitting for the person. So that is really something that you should address with your workplace safety specialist or possibly your state safety specialist.
Thank you, Gina. All right, next question. What tests are needed to identify all the toxins that Ben mentioned in his portion?
Could you repeat that, Devin?
Yeah. What tests are needed to identify all the toxins that you mentioned? And I believe,
for example, to analyze those toxins, ideally you can use the mass spec method, the LC-MS-MS. Typically, those can cover the majority of the common toxins that we run across, like antitoxin A or saxitoxin. There's a suite of microcystins and their variants, and cylindrospermopsin.
All right. Thank you, Ben. Next question. Will methods for presence or absence be covered for turbid water conditions?
Yeah, I'm not quite sure what that person is asking. For turbid water, you can have many things that causes turbidity in water, including sediments and cyanobacteria. So depending on what questions you're trying to ask about that, that's something you might need to grab a sample, possibly settle it, or let planktonic cyanobacteria float to the surface and then examine that with a microscope.
Thank you, Gina. All right, next question. So benthic blooms in comparison to planktonic can be harder to identify, as visual accumulations are not necessarily there. How can lake managers, public water systems, et cetera, be aware of benthic bloom formation and get ahead?
I can answer that. That's a great question. And I recommend that you check out ITRC's benthic HCB guidance that's online, and sign up for our training for the benthic HCB guidance that's going to be offered on Thursday, so 2 days from now.
All right, thank you, Gina. Next question. As samples can only provide information on whether there are currently toxins in the water, is there a recommendation, or is there a recommended sample frequency or duration to assess whether there is no longer a risk to public health? Or is this something that each entity will have to decide for themselves?
You know, I would say that's something that each entity decides for themselves. Typically, that involves kind of getting to know your water body a little better. What conditions tend to promote blooms? What conditions tend to alleviate the blooms? I would say like the blooms can be highly variable from, you know, hour to hour, even day to day and week to week. So typically, I mean, for instance, in Utah, for example, we typically wait 2 weeks until two consistent results turn around conditions below action levels before we make an advisory change.
All right. Thank you, Ben. Next question. Are there recommendations on use of advisory, warning, or danger signs for local versus regional lakewide areas? For example, if scums are only in a beach area, but other areas of the lake are only moderately impacted.
And I can take a stab at this one as well. Again, this is a more local decision. It really depends on what kind of resources you have at your disposal. If you're covering a large geographic area with multiple blooms, you may only have the resources to cover that from a larger geographic area. If you have perhaps somebody more local that can visit the area more frequently and they have the ability to provide that kind of signage precision to your water body, then please take advantage of that.
Thank you, Ben. All right, next question. When sampling, do you bias sample scums or try to get a general sample of how most of the area looks? If you bias sample, could a small area of scum close a large lake?
I can answer this. This is something that you need to sort of consider when you're setting up a monitoring plan and what sort of results you're going to require in order to close part or all of the lake. Some agencies will use a scum sample to get an idea of sort of the worst possible conditions that someone could be exposed to at a beach, while other agencies such as Ohio's EPA recommends doing transects at different depths in order to get a composite sample at a beach area. So this is something you need to determine when you're setting up your monitoring plan and when you're developing your communication plan and what your response criteria are going to be.
All right. Thank you, Gina. Next question. Do you have sampling protocols specifically for potential benthic cyanobacteria available, especially for rivers or streams?
I can answer that as well. That's something, again, I would encourage you to check out the ITRC benthic HCB guidance that covers benthic cyanobacteria and tune in on Thursday for our training for that guidance document.
All right. Thank you, Gina. Next question. What is the latest research about how far aerosolized toxins can travel? I have people ask me every year if they can travel across their yards, streets, et cetera.
I can address that. I know that there is ongoing research in both Florida and in Lake Erie on this question. There's a lot more that we know about red tides, which are caused by dinoflagellate algae. They're a marine kind of algae. There is increasing research and active research on answering that aerosol question in inland water bodies. Right now, what we know is that large water bodies, since you've got a longer expanse of it and possibly stronger winds, such as wind going across Lake Erie, Great Lake, that has greater potential to transport aerosols. And in inland, smaller inland water bodies, that's really going to depend a lot on weather conditions and the distance that the winds can pass over a lake.
All right. Thank you, Gina. Next question. Could CB, risks to groundwater, including shallow wells and water storage, become more significant with climate change. Any recommendations for these systems?
I would say, like, of our panel here, we don't have our drinking water person on with us today. So I don't know. I'd be willing to speculate whether it would get worse or not. but it's something that we've thought through. There aren't any really good examples because these kinds of systems tend to be private wells or privately owned. And that's an issue in and of itself, where it's, you know, they're disparate populations and not a centralized system. So that's definitely a layered issue to consider. In our benthic cyanobacteria HCB2 guidance, we have a little bit of a discussion on some of that. So check that out. I think we can provide a link to that document here in the chat.
All right. Thank you, Ben. Next question. If an agency is just establishing a new cyanotoxin monitoring program, which toxins would be most common or important to analyze in regards to public safety and recreational use reservoirs?
I can cover this. Now, microcystin is probably the most commonly occurring cyanotoxin that we see in the United States. So that is quite often the most commonly tested for toxin that we have. If you are setting up a monitoring program, it might make sense to set aside some money just to get some baseline data on the water bodies you're monitoring and do a little bit more in-depth exploration just to see if you have a cyanobacteria species present that can produce some of these toxins other than microcystin. And that will give you a better idea of what you are dealing with in those water bodies. And then you can sort of target your monitoring efforts going forward from there.
Thanks, Gina. All right, one last question for this Q&A break, and then we will have another one at the end. So does conventional drinking water treatment take care of all toxins? Would longer chlorine contact time get rid of all toxins, including antitoxin A?
Again, I would recommend that you visit our guidance document on that. We reference AWWA's guidance on how to treat cyanotoxins. Certainly, they're professionals with that kind of analytical background on that, and I do believe that they cover that very question specifically. So I'd recommend checking out our document, which provides a link to that guidance.
All right, thank you, Ben. So with that, we will close this Q&A portion and move on to our next section, which will be Christine, I believe. All right, Christine, when you are ready.
Okay, great. Thanks, Devin. So in this portion of the training, we're going to talk about how you can use risk communication and risk communication planning to improve your response to harmful cyanobacterial blooms. We'll cover the basics of risk communication, response during a bloom, and long-term planning to prepare for blooms in the future. So you may be wondering what risk communication is and how it's different from other forms of communication. Risk communication offers a science-based approach for communicating effectively in situations that are high stress, unfamiliar, or controversial. It provides people with the information they want or need to make informed decisions about threats to their health and safety. And like all effective forms of communication, it customizes messages to meet the needs of different audiences. Sorry about that. There we go. Effective risk communication helps you build a good relationship with your audience, a relationship that is based on shared goals, values, and problem solving. The following risk communication best practices can help you cultivate that relationship during a bloom event. Start by learning what your audience knows about the risk and listening to their concerns. Convey information in a way that your audience can understand. Combine understanding and empathy into your explanations of risk. And build trust and credibility through accurate information and frequent updates. Consistent, concise messaging is critical to effective risk communication. Message mapping helps you create brief yet comprehensive messages. The message mapping process helps you identify three short key messages that answer questions about who, what, when, why, where, and how. Remember, when people are under stress, they have difficulty understanding and retaining information. So take that into account when developing your messages. Your key messages should include information about health risks, health advisories, and water-related activities that may threaten human or animal health. Once you've developed your key messages, coordinate and collaborate with other credible sources to help reinforce these messages. And finally, meet the needs of the media. They can help you get your message out, but only if you organize your information and provide it to them in a timely manner. Preparation is the key to successful risk communication. That's why it's important to have a plan in place before you need it. A plan helps you identify issues as well as your potential audiences and their needs, create clear and concise messaging, and anticipate problems so you can address them beforehand. It's also important to evaluate your communication efforts after the fact and see what worked and didn't work and make adjustments to your plan. If you're interested in more information about how to develop a risk communication plan, consult the ITRC Risk Communication Toolkit on the ITRC website. Harmful cyanobacterial blooms require two types of planning: an immediate communication and monitoring response plan to be used during the bloom, and a long-term response plan that's built and updated during the off-season. This training and the accompanying HCB guidance document will help you prepare these two types of plans. Immediate HCB response planning consists of five key elements: reporting, notification, and coordination, bloom confirmation, drinking water source identification and response, issuance of health advisories, and reporting on HCB-related illnesses. Let's take a few minutes to walk through each of these key elements. It's critical to establish, It's critical to establish effective reporting and notification methods so you can respond quickly and efficiently when a bloom occurs. You want to develop a reporting mechanism that can be used by partner agencies, stakeholders, and members of the public, and make sure that all bloom reports go to a centralized location. You'll also want to set up a process for alerting other organizations, such as the health department, state parks, or lake managers, to let them know that you've received a report of a bloom. Once you've notified your partners, coordinate a bloom response that may include sampling or site visits. Finally, you'll want to notify the public when you confirm the presence of an HCB. Tell the public what you know and that your data are preliminary. Outline the steps you will be taking to ascertain the severity of the bloom, and let them know when you will provide them with an update. After you receive a bloom report, you can use visual observations to help you determine if the suspected bloom is an HCB. You can also use remote sensing to provide you with additional info on bloom size or characteristics before visiting the site. It's best if you identify your field sampling objectives before you go so you have the necessary sampling equipment. Once there, you can decide where on the water body to sample to give you the clearest picture of water conditions. Before you collect samples, consider the type of lab analysis you have in place and the sampling data required to issue a health advisory. As Ben mentioned in the previous training segment on monitoring, the monitoring section of the HCB guidance document and the interactive monitoring tool can help you decide which sampling methods make sense for you. Communication and outreach are critical to an effective bloom response. You want to let the public and the media know what you know and don't know about the bloom and where they can go for additional information and updates during an HCB event. These information sources may include a dedicated website that offers regular updates on bloom conditions, call-in lines with pre-recorded messages, and social media channels. If possible, include information about how to report a potential HCB-related illness to your local poison control center or health agency. HCBs can impact drinking water sources, so you want to make sure you coordinate with the affected public water system if a bloom can or does affect its drinking water source. Under the best case scenario, the system already has a cyanotoxin management plan in place. But if not, the HCB guidance document on the ITRC website contains resources to help water systems prepare one. If the public water system doesn't have a plan, you can assist them by providing sampling data or collecting samples near plant intakes and outflows. The treatment plant may want to use alternative water sources until the bloom subsides. Public notification is crucial if a drinking water source is affected, particularly if the system is not equipped to remove cyanotoxins. A drinking water HCB fact sheet can help members of the public understand the situation and take appropriate actions to protect their health. Consistent signage helps the public understand the health risks in an area with an HCB. People want to know what kind of recreational activities are permitted or prohibited, and how they can protect themselves, their family, and their pets from exposure. Color coding and icons can help you deliver your message quickly and succinctly. Plain language instructions increase public understanding and compliance with health recommendations. You may also want to include more than one language on your signs to ensure your message reaches diverse populations. Experience has shown that many people are concerned about the health of their dogs and may not be aware of the dangers posed by an HCB. So include information that helps dog owners keep their pets safe. You may also want to consider installing permanent signs at water bodies that experience frequent blooms. Health advisories protect public health and safety in the event of an HCB. It's best if advisory thresholds are established before a bloom occurs. Many jurisdictions develop health-based advisory thresholds for cell count concentrations and cyanotoxins and identify the agency with the authority to issue health advisories. You may want to create a flowchart with advisory thresholds, roles and responsibilities for issuing an advisory, and requirements for lifting an advisory. Consider also how you'll post advisories. And remember, the more places you post this information, the better. Signs at the bloom location, a press release, a dedicated website with frequent updates, and social media platforms are all good ways to get the word out. Let's see, get that to do right. There we go. It's important to provide members of the public with information about the health risks posed by exposure to HCBs and how they can protect themselves, their families, and their pets. Centralized reporting and data collection are key to effective incident reporting. So you want to identify an agency or organization the public can contact to report symptoms and the location of their exposure. Some states partner with their local poison control center or health agency to gather health data. When people report a human or animal illness related to an HCB exposure, be sure to notify the public so others can avoid areas that might pose a health risk. So let's talk for a minute about how you could use risk communication to address an HCB. In this scenario, a dog becomes seriously ill after playing in the water at Largeville Reservoir. Your agency suspects a harmful cyanobacterial bloom. Largeville and Smallburg residents are unfamiliar with HCBs and are worried about their health and safety. Fortunately, your agency has dealt with HCBs in other parts of the state, so you're prepared. Let's walk through the five steps of an immediate bloom response to see how your agency might handle this bloom event. Step one, reporting, notification, and coordination. Your agency receives a call from a vet on your 24-hour HCB report line after treating a dog for suspected cyanotoxin poisoning. The vet tells you that the dog was playing around the boat ramp at Largeville Reservoir before falling ill. The duty officer on the report line notifies agency staff and partner agencies about the incident. State park staff volunteered to sample the area near the boat ramp that afternoon. You notify the public immediately about the possible HCB using your social media channels and promise updates as soon as you know more. Step 2, bloom confirmation. State park staff collect samples and deliver them to the lab before it closes for the day. Your agency has the samples analyzed for toxins since the dog fell ill so suddenly. The lab reports that there are high levels of cyanotoxins in the samples. You immediately use all available media channels to let the public know what you know about the bloom and how people can protect themselves and their pets until more is known. This information helps people stay calm. You direct residents and the media to your website and social media accounts for info and updates on the situation and provide a toll-free number for the local poison control center. Further investigation shows the bloom originated at Smallberg Lake. Your agency briefs city officials, directors of the scout camp near the lake, the state park, and county park officials on the situation. You also schedule a town hall for Largeville and Smallberg residents to answer questions. Step 3, drinking water response. Drinking water staff at your agency contact the Largeville drinking water plant about the bloom. The utility doesn't have a cyanotoxin response plan, so your staff offer to collect samples at the plant intake and outflow. The plant closes the water intake from Largeville Reservoir and uses an alternative source until more is known about the extent of the bloom. The drinking water plant issues a press release to let residents know their drinking water is safe, along with the steps it's taking to protect public health. Step 4, health advisories. The local health department confirms that cyanotoxin levels exceed health advisory thresholds and closes the area of the Largeville Reservoir near the boat ramp. The rest of the reservoir and Smallberg Lake are put under a health advisory. The health department and your agency provide bilingual signage for the lake and reservoir and issue a press release to notify residents about the advisory. You also post the information to your social media accounts. Step 5, illness reporting. Several families recreating near the boat ramp experienced vomiting and diarrhea a few days after the dog fell ill. They call the local poison control center to report their symptoms. The center staff collect their information, tell them to contact their physician, and put the information in the center's HCB database. So remember how we talked earlier about key messages and message mapping? Here are 3 key messages you might use to inform the public and the media about the bloom. These messages are short and to the point and answer who, what, where, when, why, and how. The words highlighted in red show who is providing the information, what residents want and need to know, and how they can stay safe. So your agency identified what? A harmful cyanobacterial bloom in where? Smallberg Lake and Largeville Reservoir. The health department who issued health advisories what for toxins what? Do not swim in the water and obey posted notices. This gives people the information they need and that they can retain so that they can stay safe in the event of a bloom. Okay. There we go. Long-term bloom response planning. Long-term bloom planning generally takes place during the off-season. This is the time to review lessons learned from the previous HCB season to prepare for the next. Notice that many of the features of long-term planning were critical to the successful response in the HCB scenario we discussed. Long-term response planning includes routine and response sampling and monitoring plans, drinking water emergency response planning, communication and outreach, collaboration with partners, data management optimization, evaluation of reporting and communication of HCB-related illnesses, and an evaluation of the current response plan. Risk communication is an important component of an effective bloom response. As we discussed at the beginning of this portion of the training, risk communication provides members of the public the information they want and need to make informed decisions about the risks from HCB. Planning is an integral part of the bloom response process. That's why it's important to develop immediate and long-term plans to address HCBs before, during, and after a bloom event. And finally, clear messaging and timely communication about HCBs build the trust and credibility needed for your agency to protect public health during a bloom event. You can find additional information in the risk communication section of the HCB guidance document, as well as the ITRC risk communication toolkit, both of which are available on the ITRC website. And now it's my pleasure to introduce Liz Smith with the Kansas Department of Health and the Environment, who's going to talk about management and control strategies for HCBs.
Thank you, Christine. Welcome to Section 6 of the guidance document. In previous segments, you learned about identification, response, and communication, and in the next one, you'll learn about watershed level approaches. But this section focuses on managing and controlling blooms in lakes and other water bodies. Help, we have a bloom. Naturally, we hope that lake managers and stakeholders will explore ITRC's HB resource before they're confronted with a crisis. However, we recognize that people might arrive needing help. This section of the document is designed with that in mind. Our goal is to provide an organized, cohesive framework for you to learn about different strategies and evaluate their suitability for use in a given situation. The web portal allows users to browse online and download documents directly from Section 6 and the strategy fact sheets in Appendix C. It also allows users to explore options interactively using the online strategy selection tool. Let's take a tour. Sorry, I'm having difficulties with advancing slides. Devin, can you take over?
Yeah, Liz, I'm here. I can do that.
Okay. Could you move me back to next? Thanks. Okay, let's dive into the guidance document. Section 6 is pretty short, but it's important. It provides an overview of considerations that apply broadly to all in-lake control and treatment strategies. It includes a review of some factors that you'll want to account for before selecting an approach. You'll also find a summary table listing the 24 strategies that were researched in depth. You'll notice that the entries in this table are hot linked. Next. And those links in the table lead directly to Appendix C. This is where you'll find over 70 pages of detailed content. There's a downloadable fact sheet for each of the 24 strategies. There's also a cost comparison table and a short summary of about half a dozen additional strategies that are not covered in depth individually. The modular structure makes it easy for resource managers to focus only on those strategies that are suitable for their situation. Next. So how did the team decide which strategies to include in the fact sheets? First, they are limited to freshwater and estuary water bodies rather than marine systems. We also focused on open water bodies and excluded treatment methods that are used primarily in drinking water or wastewater utilities. Engineered water systems have a different set of considerations, as well as a robust body of supporting research and literature. Most importantly, the strategies included here are those that have been evaluated in peer-reviewed mainstream scientific literature or in government agency white papers. There are a number of methods, both old and new, that at this time have primarily anecdotal support or support only from vendors and not yet from independent evaluators. These methods were not included. A quick note, although the fact sheets and the online selection tool were originally focused on planktonic blooms, both have been updated to include benthics. Next. So let's look at a fact sheet. Each one is designed to stand alone, but they have a common structure to facilitate comparison. This one is for hypolimnetic oxygenation and aeration. The header shows the type of strategy as well as the strength of support for its use in both planktonic and benthic blooms. A strategy is considered an intervention if it's meant to be used on active blooms, whereas a prevention is used to reduce likelihood or intensity of future blooms. Supporting data is considered substantial if the evidence of its effectiveness is clear and robust. For a strategy that's not been studied as thoroughly or that has had some mixed results, it might be limited. Meanwhile, a relatively new method that has mostly laboratory rather than field support might be scored as emerging. Note that because there has been less research on strategies for benthic blooms, some may be characterized as unknown type with no supporting data for benthics only. The fact sheet starts with a general technical description, which may be illustrated with photos or diagrams. Then there's a checklist to summarize the conditions where the treatment has been demonstrated most effective and the type of bloom for which it's best suited. Later in the fact sheet, you'll find a summary of advantages and limitations, followed by a brief cost analysis, at least one case study, and notes about regulatory and policy considerations. The literature references for each fact sheet are also included to make further research easy for the user. Next. So, is choosing a strategy as easy as choosing a fact sheet that looks good? Of course not. If there were one perfect affordable method to control every bloom, then every lake manager would be using it. Instead, we know that HCBs, like all other problems that are both complex and persistent, attract many attempts at treatments and solutions. To use a medical analogy, the water body is not well, and HCBs are the manifestation of sickness. And we have a landscape of treatment options before us, old and new, short-term, long-term, more or less invasive, more or less costly. But different treatments are better suited for different cases. The more you know about the situation, the better your odds of making a good choice. So this resource does not give prescriptions, but instead serves as a compendium aimed at providing the user with a systematic overview of strategies that have support in current peer-reviewed literature. It's not intended to promote one strategy over another, but to support informed decision-making, to help you consider the context, understand the constraints, weigh pros and cons, and set realistic expectations for outcomes. Next. To make the best possible decision, we want to sort through our options in a logical way. We can group strategies according to a variety of factors. So what are the top level considerations? First, each strategy can be characterized as a prevention, an intervention, or both. Next, what type of water body is affected? Is it a pond, typically with a depth of 10 feet or less, a lake or reservoir, a larger water body that has a residence time of over a year, or a river? And finally, are you concerned primarily with planktonic or benthic blooms? As you'll see in a moment, these are the factors that serve as primary filtering criteria in the interactive management criteria selection tool on the web portal. Next. Previous, please. Thanks. But before we go there, if we're serious about identifying a strategy for a real-world situation, let's collect some additional information. First, we want to know more about our water body. Characteristics like surface area and depth, residence time, mixing regime, and natural turbidity and chemistry will affect our choices. Also, if a lake is highly enriched, eutrophic, it's important to know whether that input is from internal loading or ongoing from the watershed. Are there use-related factors that might limit our choices? For example, is this a drinking water storage reservoir? Or are there swim beaches? Is it home to protected species or invasive species? If your water body has seasonal or other special influences to consider, for example, ice cover or regulated water level changes, make note of those too. Next, please. And of course, we want to know as much as possible about the bloom. Is it a new problem or is there a history of frequent recurrence? When does it occur? Is there an element of seasonal predictability? And what about location and scale? Does it tend to start or accumulate in a certain area? How bad is it? Is it mild or intense? And finally, do you know what species are most abundant and whether cyanotoxins have been detected? Next. And last but not least, there are always the practical and human considerations. How important is bloom control relative to other management and use priorities? Are the littoral zones important for fish spawning? Is it more important to have swimmable beaches in July or safe drinking water year-round? Are there other management actions in place that could present conflicting goals? Next, what are your logistic constraints? The immediate budget, the ongoing budget, and your available infrastructure and staffing. It's important to consider whether there are regulations that constrain options too. For example, placing structures on the lake bed or applying algicides. This varies from state to state and sometimes at a local or water body level. It's also important to consider stakeholder perspectives and overall risk tolerance of managers and the community, including downstream neighbors, which is a major consideration for both rivers and reservoirs. Next. So, with all this information assembled, we're ready to explore the options. As we know, the web portal offers Section 6 and Appendix C for online browsing or download. In addition, there's the Management Criteria Selection tool, which allows users to explore options interactively. So let's use it to explore that scenario on Smallberg Lake. Next. What do we know about the situation? This is a shallow, well-mixed 50-acre lake with unregulated outflow. It has nutrient loading from septic systems, resident waterfowl, and probably row crops in the watershed. There's a golf course too. It's loosely managed by the county. There's a county park and a scout camp on the north side and a private shoreline on the south. Residents know that it gets green during most dry summers, but there's been no real concern in the past. However, a visiting colleague from Largeville Reservoir recognized the green as an HCB, tested the bloom, and found toxins, which put an immediate stop to recreational use. Next. The county is starting from scratch. They've never thought about HCB management before. They are interested in both intervention and prevention for the long term, and they know it's a planktonic bloom. We recall that this is a small recreational lake, well mixed with a long residence time. What else do we know? It's eutrophic, probably with some regular external nutrient loading. Managers are open-minded about options. They're willing to explore methods with limited or emerging field support, as well as those with substantial research evidence to support them. Next. Sorry. Rather than reading 70 pages of fact sheets, they start with interactive tool on the web portal to explore the 24 strategies and apply the factors just discussed. Because they're using such broad selection criteria for a common water body type, only one option is eliminated as a candidate. However, using the additional sorting factors in the output table, they're able to eliminate 5 more strategies, 2 that are not recommended for turbid lakes, and 3 that are not relevant for shallow lakes. Next. So this diagram shows the 18 candidates. It includes a range of strategies that have emerging, limited, and substantial supporting data. But in theory, they might all be possibilities for use in this relatively small, shallow system. 5 strategies are characterized as prevention only, 4 as intervention only, and 9 may be considered for both. The next step is to investigate them further. Next, please. Stakeholders want the lake's problem fixed ASAP, so the county convenes a community meeting with speakers from the Largeville University Environmental Science Department, the County Extension Office, and lake managers from nearby Largeville Reservoir. The speakers remind everyone that there's no universal solution, so they need to discuss options. Let's walk through the options with the stakeholder community. First, they eliminate monitored natural attenuation. They want something done now, before the 4th of July. Next, 2 physical methods are rejected: dredging for being too invasive and too expensive, and hydraulic flushing because it's not compatible with the dam outflow structure. Dye shading is rejected because it would change the lake's appearance too much. After more research and discussion, several other methods are rejected for being too untested, locally unavailable, or too expensive. These include food web and microbial biomanipulation, flocculation, nanoparticles, ozonation, organic biocides, skimming, and harvesting. And finally, the university expert cautions that phosphorus-binding compounds may not be the best solution since the lake continues to have nutrient input from the watershed. So that's set aside too. The universe of options has been quickly constrained through careful consideration. Fortunately, there are still some viable options to work with. Some are well tested, others have limited support, but the stakeholders are willing to consider them all. They check with the State Department of Environmental Quality to see whether there are any regulatory constraints. They learn that all the remaining strategies are allowable, though some regulations may apply and permits may be necessary. So the county decides to apply peroxide, algicide, lakewide. If this doesn't work, they'll have another meeting to consider a one-time use of copper algicide. Next summer, the emphasis will be on prevention. The county staff, with volunteer help from the scouts, will install barley straw in the north part of the lake next spring. With some help from the golf course, the Homeowners Association is buying an ultrasound device for their corner of the lake, and they'll research floating wetlands as well. Next. So to review, the stakeholder and management group has decided to adopt a variety of approaches. The county does not want to treat the lake year after year, but they'll hire a lake management company to knock down this year's bloom with algicide, first with peroxide and with chelated copper as a backup. During and after the algicide application, no recreational use will be permitted and the cyanotoxins would be monitored until they fall below levels of concern. Over the coming months, the county will work to acquire barley straw to install on the North Shoreline next spring. Meanwhile, the Homeowners Association and golf course will buy an ultrasound device and research floating wetlands. As you may already have guessed, the county government has wisely recognized this as an opportunity to strengthen communication and monitoring. They're convening a stakeholder group that includes both lake and watershed interests, and they've agreed to pay for lakewide toxin testing, working with Largeville University scientists to track the results and update the community through both traditional and social media. Next. Before implementing a strategy, let's go back to Section 6 of the document to make sure we've not forgotten anything. Yes, the county has done these things. As part of choosing a strategy, they've researched permit requirements and checked in with stakeholders. They've considered the possible side effects and deemed them acceptable, given the uses of the lake. They've gotten estimates from several different lake management companies and reviewed the short and long-term budget impacts, as well as logistics. Finally, they are working with the community to communicate their goals and plans. Next. Perhaps most importantly, the county now knows that in order to evaluate different strategies, it's important to monitor both before and after implementation in both the treated and control areas if possible. For Smallberg Lake, they're trying one strategy in the North Cove and one in the South. They plan to monitor conditions in both locations, as well as at the dam where no treatment is being applied. With help from experts at Largeville University, they'll collect samples for toxins and cell counts on a weekly basis before and after the treatment, along with dissolved oxygen and nutrients. The county has asked the State Wildlife Agency and the State Regulatory Agency to review their plans. Both agencies agree that it's important to measure dissolved oxygen and toxins when they're applying any algicide. They like the monitoring plan, and they note that the lake management contractor that was selected is well established and familiar with the permit process. Next. So as we've seen with the Smallberg Lake example, adaptive management will increase your odds of understanding and success. HCBs are complex phenomena. No two are exactly the same. Set realistic expectations, make methodical, careful decisions based on as much data as possible, but also remain flexible and learn from every attempt, whether successful or not. This is how adaptive management works. That first toxic bloom can induce panic, so it may require conscious effort to take a step back and look at the big picture, to consider the fiscal, practical, and ecological consequences of any approach. Use the event as an opportunity to recruit allies and communicate with stakeholders. If intervention strategies are planned, determine in advance what cue will trigger an intervention. And of course, throughout implementation of any strategy, include a monitoring plan that will close the loop and allow you to assess the effectiveness of your management and control efforts. Next. One final note. The fact sheets presented in Appendix C do not include everything on the market today, and certainly not everything that will be on the market tomorrow. Complex and persistent problems continue to inspire many attempts to solve them, and new options are emerging constantly. So when you encounter a new option, evaluate it systematically by asking the same questions. Are peer-reviewed independent field studies available? Does evidence match claims? Does it fit your particular water body and management goals? What are the upfront and recurring costs? How often does the treatment need to be applied and to what extent? And what are the possible short and long-term impacts to the water body? Finally, is it reversible or will it leave a lasting impact? Are there possible side effects or residuals? These are all important questions. Next. So what are our key takeaways? As we've seen, the options can seem overwhelming, but you can improve your odds of success by learning as much as possible about your water body and the bloom. Then set goals realistically relative to water body uses and fiscal and other constraints. Consider whether a proposed strategy treats a symptom or addresses underlying causes. Include a well-designed monitoring plan with your treatment so that you can evaluate efficacy. You can use the management and control section of the ITRC guidance document to help you work through all the steps and considerations. And most importantly, understand that in-lake management strategies are just one part of a bigger picture that includes understanding and monitoring of HCBs, response and communication, and watershed management. And with that mention of watershed management, I'd like to welcome back Ben Holcomb from the Utah DEQ. Thanks.
All right. Thank you, Liz. So let's jump into the final module, HCB nutrient reduction strategies. So this module covers section 7 of the document. To provide some initial context, I plan to discuss these four categories of nutrient management with you today. I'm going to give you a review of factors influencing HCBs. I'm going to cover steps for success. And then I'm going to review our ITRC HCB web portal and tools. And then I'm going to go through a scenario application. As you may have learned through the introduction training module, there are a number of known variables that contribute to HCBs and yet many unknowns that influence the extent, magnitude, and duration of these blooms. Nutrients, light availability and temperature, and the timing of the three as they relate to seasonal growth strongly influence planktonic HCB formation. However, of these variables, nutrients are the contributor that we can only hope to control on a local level that may lead to preventing blooms. The most prominent source of nutrients will vary by location, making it important for water managers to understand the land use and the surrounding area. There's significant difficulty removing nutrients from our waterways. They're pervasive and found naturally throughout our watersheds. They're intertwined with our everyday life. They are persistent and can accumulate within a watershed. Finally, they are a necessity for growth and ecological function, so optimal amounts vary with time and location. In this training and our guidance, we place more emphasis on the carrot approaches to reducing nutrients. However, there are regulatory aspects with controlling nutrients within many states that can be employed, which can assist with a stick approach when needed. These nutrients, nitrogen and phosphorus, are typically the elements that limit growth in terrestrial and particularly aquatic ecosystems where we find HCBs. So as more are added to the system, more growth occurs. Let's briefly cover how human activities can increase the levels of these nutrients in our water bodies. Phosphorus, in contrast to its elemental form, which is used every day in our LED light bulbs, for example, it's found as phosphate outside the laboratory. As an element in a molecule, it's sticky. So aside from point source effluent discharges, it's generally related to sediment erosion and transport within your watershed. In terms of sources, there are a few major contributors, such as waste disposal and runoff from animals and humans, when it's applied as a concentrated fertilizer for crop growth, and when industrially used in detergents or for production of materials. As for nitrogen, besides its use in the explosion of airbag deployment, nitrogen is most commonly found in gaseous form. Because of that, its cycling in the natural environment is more complicated than phosphorus, and therefore limiting nitrogen and having the same effect is more tricky. Particularly if you recall from the introduction module that some cyanos can fix nitrogen from the atmosphere and bring it into the aquatic environment. Nonetheless, it too shares a number of sources similar to those of phosphor sources. For this training and our guidance, we're not wading into the debate of whether reducing phosphorus or nitrogen is more important. Both are important for growth, so it greatly depends on the ecology of your water body, the relative contributions from sources within the watershed and water body, and the timing of when these nutrients are available in molecular form for cyanobacterial growth. With that said, it's critically important that you understand whether the dominant sources of nutrients are arriving from outside the lake, that is, external loading from the watershed, or is it predominantly originating from within the lake itself, which is termed internal loading. Depending on the depth of your water body, internal loading may occur through different mechanisms. Shallow water bodies may experience internal loading due to resuspension of sediments from wave action, whereas deeper waters may experience this loading through a chemical reaction when oxygen levels at the sediment surface become depleted, which results in phosphorus and nitrogen molecules being released into the water. Then, depending on mixing ability, such as the turnover frequency in a stratified lake, the nutrients become available to primary producers like cyanobacteria. This training module is focused on nutrient management strategies that originate from external loading. For ideas to tackle nutrients due to internal loading, please revisit the in-lake treatment training, which is module 4, and visit section 6 of the document. For practical purposes, it's critical to tackle your external sources of nutrients first, or the strategies applied to treat internal loading will likely be short-lived. There are numerous approaches and strategies to cover this topic. The HCB team created this section and web portal to assemble relevant information that we found useful into one place. However, if you're following these basic steps, it will help organize your approach implementing these strategies successfully. Some steps may require substantial resources, but even limited amounts of data and information may be very useful in identifying the priorities. The steps are to explore the issues with regulatory agencies. Step 2 is to gather the information. 3, develop actions that secure community cooperation. 4, determine the critical areas for implementation of nutrient management strategies, or prioritize your actions. 5, implement those strategies using the most efficient and targeted approaches. And 6, evaluate the effectiveness, adapt, document, and share your lessons learned and success stories. So the first step, explore the issue with regulatory agencies. So it's first to begin by contacting your local and state agencies to determine whether nutrients have been identified as an issue in your watershed and whether watershed plans or nutrient concentration goals such as watershed loads or site-specific criteria have already been developed for the HCB-affected water body. More information regarding this step is found in section 7.2. Step 2. It's time to characterize relative nutrient loading using models and monitoring as necessary. Identify predominant nutrient sources in the watershed and prioritize nutrient sources for reduction. Leverage local knowledge, review permitting databases, et cetera, if no previous assessment exists. Check out US EPA's How's My Waterway website because it was designed to provide information collected from states, tribes, and local agencies related to the condition of water bodies throughout the US. Consider using the nutrient source tracking tool to assist with characterizing primary nutrient sources and visit the recovery potential screening tool that was designed for your state, which is found on EPA's website. For more information regarding this step, it can be found in section 7.3, which provides specific examples and resources. Step 3, discover and reach out to affected stakeholders. So build outreach and education. This is a critical step that's often overlooked because resource managers tend to focus on the technical issues. but stakeholders can assist by seeking information and filling data gaps identified in the previous steps. They can assist with seeking funding and funding strategies. Many of the success stories that we've discovered share the trait of funding through shared partnerships. And finally, with implementing your projects. When developing your outreach, consider the languages, culture, events, and demographics of the place and community. Also consider conducting educational outreach at schools. For additional info on this subject, visit section 7.2. In addition, for specific examples and resources for this objective, review the HCB web portal and HCB risk communication in section 5. Step 4, prioritize your actions. So this step is really where your efforts will pay off. It's also the most difficult step. Because there are a multitude of potential actions that can lead to nutrient reduction in a myriad of scenarios, the ITRC team emphasize our efforts towards compiling these strategies into a single location with an easy-to-use graphic that categorizes strategies based on nutrient sources. Visit section 7.4 for more information. And later in the training, I'll cover a scenario on how to use the tools we've created to assist you with these decisions. All right, step 5. So this is usually the fun, exciting, and fulfilling step. You get to spend all those funds that your team worked hard to secure. Just remember, for physical and structural strategies, ensure you have secured the appropriate permits before beginning your work. There are numerous case studies and examples found throughout Section 7 of the document that we've compiled there. Step 6, effectiveness monitoring. As mentioned in Module 4, before implementing all of these steps, it's critical to devote time incorporating a monitoring plan that documents whether the actions taken were successful. This is particularly important when justifying the costs expended for the project to the funding entities, and it's also helpful for funding or for securing future funding as well as identifying lessons learned from unsuccessful projects. It's important that you compile that information and share it, whether it was successful or not, because everything is a learned opportunity. To put these steps into context, it's helpful to remember that excess nutrients can be regulated under the Clean Water Act. There are mechanisms to achieve reductions through these means. However, because nutrients can originate from both regulated, that is, point sources, and unregulated sources, non-point sources, most effective successes occur through a combination of regulatory and incentive programs. When you get started, it's important to ask these questions. Have goals been established for your water body? Have total maximum daily loads, that is TMDLs, been established? Have load allocations been implemented into discharge permits? For more information on this topic, visit section 7.2. So we've broken nutrient sources into point and non-point sources. Point sources are the regulated ones. Non-point sources aren't regulated unless a TMDL has been approved. So we've categorized point sources into municipal and industrial discharges, stormwater, and agriculture, specifically confined animal feeding operations, or CAFOs. As mentioned earlier, non-point sources aren't regulated, but there are a number of established programs that incentivize nutrient reduction practices. Non-point sources were categorized as agricultural, septic wastewater management, forest management, roadway management, and hydrologic and habitat modification, specifically shoreline, riparian, and wetland areas. So water quality trading spans both point and non-point source categories because it's typically deployed as a tool across these nutrient source categories. Water quality trading is based on the premise that nutrient control from sources may require costly measures, while measures to reduce the same nutrient at other sources are less expensive. So for example, this may arise when treating nutrients at a point source becomes prohibitively more expensive than if these funds were deployed within the watershed at other sources that could reduce nutrients even more. Trading allows greater, less costly nutrient reductions from one source to be transferred to another source where reductions may be more expensive. This flexibility allows for better outcomes at lower costs. Water quality trading promotes nutrient reduction at lower costs while advancing improved environmental conditions. Visit section 7.7 to learn more about this. So now let's showcase some of the tools we've assembled. First is this strategy selection graphic. Each red dot corresponds to the point and non-point source categories that I just described. Hovering over the dot pops up a window that provides links to the strategies. This is just a screenshot, so you're not going to see it pop up. So the strategies include links to resources and examples of these strategies in use across the country. And the strategies were broken into two themes, structural and non-structural. And to define that, structural strategies and nutrient management are typically incorporate physical treatment, which can either be passive and natural or active and mechanical. Non-structural strategies are generally programmatic in nature, such as education and outreach, regulation and enforcement, maintenance, or source control. In addition, we've compiled these strategies into an easy-to-read table, which is found in section 7.4. And each of these provides a hyperlink to the resources we're compiling. So let's go through a scenario. This scenario will mainly focus the objectives of step four, which is to identify and prioritize strategies, the more intricate and kind of time-consuming step. So this is Largeville Reservoir. It's a semi-urban lake that includes point and non-point sources. It has high recreational use, and it has a source of drinking water, as noted here in this rural water intake. So zooming out and taking a look at the landscape and looking upstream at where potential nutrient sources can occur, we see a few potential sources. Again, to provide some context, here's the rural water intake at the kind of the head of the reservoir. Upstream, we have a place called Farmtown that includes feedlots that are near a tributary. And also we have this area called Smallburg, which is a small community that includes a lake. So zooming in on Smallburg, we see that it contains a wastewater treatment plant, but it's not necessarily connected to any tributaries, but it does have this highly enriched lake and cabins with that are just septic based and not necessarily connected to the wastewater treatment plant. So if we were to use our graphic selection tool, I've provided an example here where we have septic system and CAFOs. As I hover over the dot, the box pops up and provides a hyperlink. So for example, if I clicked on the septic system, it would provide an introduction on what this topic entails, the different resources, the structural and non-structural strategies. And also, for example, here are the pros and cons if I were to choose CAFOs, for example. And it just kind of gives you an idea, an overview of the information that's found in these fact sheets. But finally, let me quickly touch upon a disclaimer and a cautionary tale. The climate is changing faster than our ability to reduce nutrients in our water bodies. A rapidly changing climate may confound any attempts to prevent cyanoblooms, but controlling and reducing nutrient availability to these blooms is our best hope to reduce the extent, magnitude, and duration of these events. And Lake Erie provides a cautionary tale that managing nutrients isn't just a once and done deal. It's a constant issue. Nutrients were greatly reduced through point sources at the advent of the Clean Water Act, but through time, non-point sources of nutrients began to exceed those efforts. So it may not be successful to prevent these blooms, but reducing them in some way provides us some success for controlling HCBs. And some final thoughts. There are many success stories. We've provided them in our document. A long-term full court press to reduce excess nutrients from prioritized at-risk water bodies is critical. So take your time to go through that process. Reducing nutrients in waterways takes tremendous fortitude and perseverance. It's a constant and it's not a quick fix. And then finally, ensure that you document and share information because we're all in this together to learn from one another. And with that, I will turn it over to Devin for questions.
All right, thank you, Ben. So we will begin our last question and answer portion of today's training. If you have any questions, please enter them in the chat. We will get to as many as we can. And if we cannot answer all of them, we will follow up with you directly. All right, our first question. Because the release of toxins mostly occurs after death of the cyanobacteria, is it really advisable to apply the copper biocide or peroxides as mentioned as a management tool?
Yeah, I'll take that one. That is a very astute question. Absolutely. It's important to monitor the toxin levels before and after application of biocides and make sure that they have returned to acceptable levels before the water source is used. If it's a drinking water source, of course, you want to be make sure you're in touch with the water utility so that they are well-informed. Copper, I believe there's a restriction that it can only be applied to half of a water body at any time, and then has to be the delay before you apply the other half. So you could actually have two events there. A major concern, of course, is that the decaying cyanobacteria will result in a dissolved oxygen sag, which can cause fish kills and so on. Peroxide is a little bit different. If peroxide is applied at the right concentration, it can actually chemically destroy the toxins as well. So that's why with the use of any biocide, efficacy testing or bench testing and appropriate calibration of the dose is really, really important. Good question.
All right. Thank you, Liz. Next question. Can phosphorus or volcanic soils be a large contributor of PHOs in runoff? I hope I said that right.
Yeah, I can take that. Are volcanic soils a contributor of phosphorus in runoff? I'm in Wisconsin, so the Midwest is not exactly renowned for its volcanic soils. Maybe Ben can chime in a second, but soil type will definitely affect whether phosphorus can come into water bodies with runoff. For example, Central Florida has really high levels of phosphate deposits in just as deposits and also as bedrock. So Central Florida is known for having high inputs in that way. So maybe Ben can chime in a second on volcanic soils.
Yeah, so it really kind of depends on how much iron may also be in that volcanic soil, because iron is a great binder of phosphorus. And so when phosphorus and iron bind up, they're typically difficult to break apart. But nonetheless, I think the heart of your question is that, you know, how much soils can be a contributor of phosphorus. And it's very true. Some soils have higher levels of phosphorus, and it's a really important question to answer as you start your journey of determining the sources of nutrients in your water body or your watershed. So for example, some soils maybe, if they do have higher levels than other typical soils, it's really critical that you take a look at every activity that goes into soil disturbance, whether that's, you know, ditching your roads or road building, for example, and ensuring that BMPs are done as to the best of your regulatory ability to contain any disturbance of soil first, and then containment of that soil second.
All right, thank you, Ben. Next question. What is known about agricultural use of water downstream of toxin-producing blooms? Do toxins enter the food chain that way?
Well, I can start, and if Liz has anything to add, she can chime in as well. Yeah, I know that there is some work that's going on at The Ohio State University on the potential for crops to bioaccumulate cyanobacterial toxins when they are watered with irrigation water that contains cyanobacterial toxins. So yes, that is definitely a possibility. It's something that's really an ongoing area of research, and we can't really give you any hard and fast information about that right now.
Yeah, I would add that cyanotoxins can be accumulate in fish and in crops. EPA should be coming out with a white paper on this. I don't want to give a timeline. I don't really have a good idea, but I do know that they have some draft documents that they're compiling in regards to best management practices for agricultural uses of water that may contain cyanotoxins. So far, what we're seeing is generally it's not a pervasive problem of high uptake of toxins in plants. They're generally very low, but it really depends on the type of plant and the type of irrigation that occurred. So keep that in mind, and there should be a paper coming out on that shortly.
And I want to add one more thing about irrigation, just from some of the experiences we've had in Wisconsin. If you are a homeowner that lives on a lake or reservoir that experiences cyanobacterial blooms, we recommend that if you irrigate your grass, your lawn with water from that water body, that you cease doing that if blooms are present. We have had instances, unfortunately, of pets that eat grass were adversely affected because if you're using that water containing a bloom, you're spraying it on your grass, you're basically moving those toxins up onto land, and then your dogs or even your cats, if they eat grass, can then be sickened if they're ingesting that. So something to keep in mind.
All right. Thank you, trainers, for answering those questions. And thank you, attendees, for putting those in the Q&A box for our trainers to answer. Before we end today, I would like to remind everybody that we do have a brand new HCB benthic training coming out this Thursday, same time as this training, 1 p.m. Eastern. The benthic harmful cyanobacteria bloom training provides an overview of benthic cyanobacteria and how to manage those kinds of blooms, covering five sections from the ITRC HCB2 guidance document that was recently published. I will put the link to register for that training in the chat for everybody shortly. And then we would love to see you at that training. And a special thank you to all of our attendees for coming today and taking our training. And thank you to our trainers for participating. We could not have done it without either of you. We would like to hear back from you today. So please be sure to fill out the online feedback form that is linked on this last slide. The link doesn't work, unfortunately, through this Zoom, but if you do download the materials, you can use that link through that. And then it is also on Cluin on the training page. Filling out that feedback form will allow you to get a certificate of participation for today. And at the end of the feedback form, you will just certify that you participated by checking a box, and the certificate will be emailed to you. So I will, we will close today's training. Thank you all for coming, and have a wonderful rest of your afternoon.